Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Far up the Amazon, through Brazil, into Bolivia, deep in the jungle, conquistadors and adventurers have long imagined a lost civilization, an El Dorado buried in green. A century ago, renowned explorer Percy Fawcett set his sights on finding it. He finally went in and never came back. My guest today went in after him and found his own obsession. This hour, On Point, the lost city of Z. You can join the conversation. Why do we dream of El Dorados, of lost cities, and what would you risk to try to find one? Have you been to the end of the Amazon? My guest today is David Gran, author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. In 2004, he trekked into the Amazon jungle on the trail of explorer Percy Fawcett. David Graham, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What is it that Fawcett was after here? And it goes all the way back to the conquistadors, to the 16th century. I mean, it's an enormous jungle. Why did Westerners think that there would be a city lost in the middle of it?
Well, it had always captivated the imagination of the Amazon, and it's sometimes hard to imagine its sheer size. It's really the wilderness area is about the size of the continental United States. And from the first moment when the conquistadors arrived in that area, it captivated their imagination. And they had heard stories from various Indians about this great kingdom in the jungle, a glittering kingdom. And it was said to be so rich that its inhabitants ground gold and metal into powder and they would anoint their skin. And El Dorado literally means the gilded man. And ever since they heard those stories, they were motivated primarily by greed, or actually not primarily, mm-hmm. solely by greed.
Find the gold, the city of gold,
get all that money. And they began to go in. But these stories remained for so long. And one of the reasons they remained is while the rest of the world was slowly mapped and settled and people could see, the Amazon remained this vast, uncharted wilderness because of the tenacity of the jungle. So it remained on the map, this unexplored area where people didn't know what exactly was there.
Colonel Percy Fawcett, British, comes along then, born in 1867 or so, grows up to have a tremendous interest in exploration, but he's no gold digger. What was he after here?
Well, he was very much a product of the Victorian age. He grew up during the Victorian era of exploration, and he was very much influenced by the new era of science. And science was his new god, as it was for many during this era where Darwin and other explorers had gone out into the world. And he had been sent to the Amazon area in 1906, and the area had remained so unexplored that the countries Peru, Bolivia, and Brazil didn't even know where their borders were in the interior of the Amazon, and they needed somebody to go in and map that area. So he began charting thousands of square miles of the Amazon, and during the course of these expeditions, he began to develop clues that he thought suggested that the Amazon did in fact contain an ancient and sophisticated civilization, and that became a burning obsession for him.
Now, this ran into a body of thought, though, that said that the Amazon was so inhospitable, and we'll talk about just how inhospitable. You found out yourself firsthand, but so inhospitable that there was a kind of environmental determinism here. This could never have supported an enormous civilization. How did he deal with that view?
That's right. I mean, the prevailing there were two when Fawcett came of age. There was when he was younger, the prevailing theory was actually racism was so prevalent in Victorian society and Western society. There was assumptions that Native Americans, especially in the Amazons, literally almost physically and biologically, were not capable of such great feats. this slowly started to dissipate, and biological determinism really gave way to environmental determinism. And as you said, this was this theory that the conditions in the jungle were just simply so brutal that you could never develop large enough populations, which are a precursor to any kind of complex society with divisions of labors and political hierarchies. And Fawcett battled both of these assumptions throughout his life and had to constantly combat the skeptics. For him, it only deepened his obsession, and it made him often furious with the scientific establishment.
He was a particular kind of explorer, sort of gentleman explorer trained, specifically trained at the Royal Geographical Society in London after he had been out with the Royal Artillery in Ceylon, Sri Lanka. What was the sort of the cut of cloth that they were looking for to send out in explorers? What kind of explorers were they training there in London?
Yeah, I mean, one of the funny things I came upon in my research was that, as you said, the Royal Geographic Society was almost like a finishing school for explorers, and it had helped launch such famed explorers as Livingstone and Speke. And the Royal Geographic Society was very much, I mean, it was tied into the British Empire, and there was an element of imperialism tied in with it, but they were also had a scientific project, which was to essentially map the world, to find, to develop maps of areas that remained unknown. And they were looking for people who were incredibly, had incredible fortitude. Fawcett was an incredibly just powerful human specimen and was able to endure incredible hardship. But one of the things that was interesting, they would learn not only the skills of map making at the society, but they would also learn how to survive. And this training was in the wilderness area. And this training was incredibly primitive because they just didn't have a lot of scientific development in terms of medicine at that time. So there were no immunities. And I read a lot of the manuals that Fawcett had been given to teach him how to survive in the wilderness. And they said things like, you know, if you have a snake wound, you know, and you have poison, you know, explode gunpowder in the wound. You know, if you have gangrene, just basically cut off your arm.
You'll be fine.
You'll be fine. Buck up. Right. Stiff upper lip. And they would train, and Fawcett went there to train, and then he was actually initially recruited to become a spy. And this was also very common because map makers and surveyors were provided the perfect cover for empire builders. That's right. I mean, they could send surveyors in who were supposed to be kind of nosing around and poking around with telescopes anyways. And Fawcett was sent to Africa before he went to the Amazon to explore.
So he was tough as they come. And even so, this was a pretty forbidding environment. Describe for us some of what this Amazon jungle, the southern basin, and way up, what it brings to bear on anybody who tries to hack their way through it?
Yeah, well, there were incredible obstacles. Again, back then they had almost no protection against the assault of the jungle. So there are everything from pit vipers, which are very poisonous snakes, to vampire bats. I would read a lot of the diaries of Fawcett and his companions, and when they were sleeping, they would wake up in the morning and vampire bats had left their skin streaked with blood. Probably the greatest and most lethal element, though, was the pests, the mosquitoes. Again, they had no immunities against most diseases, and so these mosquitoes would transport everything from elephantiasis to malaria to yellow fever to bone crusher fever. And Fawcett would take these expeditions, and usually half his men or more would die. The other element, and this was always somewhat counterintuitive and helped contribute to the notion that the Amazon could not support large populations, which was that explorers would go into this era, and you think of the jungle as this great bountiful era where there's going to be lots of food, but in fact, they would often starve. And part of this was that people coming into the Amazon were simply not adapted to the conditions. And they would look around them, and the predators were so much more skilled at eluding them. And also the soil, the competition, it's such a natural battlefield that the competition for nutrients from the soil can often make the soil very infertile, and so it's hard to grow any kind of crop. So starvation was often another problem, and a lot of the early El Dorado expeditions descended into cannibalism in which they would eat their own.
So this was no Eden, really, and even in the case Percy Fawcett, he went in many times, but he finally went in with his 21-year-old son and never came out. You were not the first person to try and find the answer to the riddle of what happened to this indestructible explorer.
Yes. I mean, Fawcett had been seen as, he had survived in the wilderness for nearly two decades. And when so many of his other parties would die and disappear, and he seemed so indestructible that some of his colleagues claimed he was even immune to death. But then in 1925, he went with his son and one other companion, and they vanished and were never seen again. And though Fawcett had warned that nobody should follow in his wake because of the dangerous, scores of explorers, adventurers, and scientists quickly plunged into the wilderness, determined to either recover the party alive or dead, or find evidence of Z. And countless of these expeditions died of starvation or disease. Others were killed by tribesmen who were firing arrows dipped in poison. And then there were a whole bunch who simply disappeared along with Fawcett.
And then you had the temerity to do it, and you were not exactly sort of a special forces-trained tough guy from the outback.
No, I'm the least likely explorer in the history of man. I don't hike. I don't camp. I'm unfortunately out of shape, and I have keratoconus, which is a degenerative eye condition that makes it pretty hard for me to see at night, and I tend to get lost even when I'm riding the subway to work in Manhattan. But as I began to do more and more research into this story, I just became more and more consumed with the mystery. And eventually I had gone to England had found many of Fawcett's lost diaries and logbooks. And in the course of reading those, I found unprecedented amount of clues to his route, to what may have happened to him, and to where he thought Z would be. And it was really when I found those clues that I said, you know what, I'm going to do something pretty foolish and see if I can follow him into the jungle.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for the lost city of Z, about a Victorian-era explorer's quest in the Amazon, and a contemporary writer who retraced his steps in the jungle. David Grand joins us from New York. He's author of the new book, The Lost City of Z, A Deadly Tale of Obsession in the Amazon. In 2004, he made his own trek into the Amazonian jungle in search of Percy Fawcett's Lost City of Z. Fawcett made many journeys into this jungle, never came back from his 1925 expedition. So, David, first, to his 1925 expedition, paint a picture for us of what that would have looked like, what exactly did he hope to find, and draw a map for us of where he was striding into the jungle and where his journey took him, as far as we know.
Yes. Fawcett was always very secretive about his route, where he was going to go in 1925. At the time, there was a great race to find an ancient city or civilization in the jungle. He had many rivals. Some of his rivals had a lot of funding and were very wealthy. So he was always, having been a spy, had the paranoia of a spy and always used a lot of cloak and dagger. Mm-hmm. What we knew is he was heading into the Mato Grosso region, which is in the southern basin of the Amazon in Brazil. And the Mato Grosso literally means dense forest. Mm. Now, I was able in finding his logbooks and diaries, and I even found a sketch of his map where he was going to go. And essentially, he was moving. He started in Cuiabá, which is the capital of Mato Grosso, and then was going to move north with his son and Raleigh Rimmel. And they were moving northward to a place called Bucari Post, which was kind of the last government outpost at the time before you enter the Xingu area. Xingu is a river, and that region of the jungle was utterly unexplored.
Were they always going along the river? Was it accessible any other way?
You know, that's interesting. Most Amazon expeditions would always travel by river in the past. And the reason they did this was it was easier. It was easier to carry equipment. It was also a lot safer, easier to flee if you were encountering tribes that were defending their territory. Fawcett actually, in his map, was going to cut straight through the jungle and hack through it. So even though he was moving north in that area, he was then going to cross the rivers, but he was not going to travel by river. And many people thought this was pretty mad, and it meant the conditions would be extremely brutal. You could only carry enough equipment on your packs. You would carry 60-pound packs, and they would be basically hacking through jungle every hour that they went. And Fawcett drove these parties hard, even with his son, and they would get up at the crack of dawn, and they would go just before dark, before they pitch camp. And I was able to read a lot of their letters from the expedition. One of the interesting things was that they would actually have their letters, and Fawcett also wrote dispatches, and these were carried out of the jungle by Indian runners, and then they were brought to the nearest city. They would take weeks to arrive, and then they were typed up by telegraphs and sent out around the world. So the entire world was basically holding its breath, captivated by this expedition. It was one of the first great kind of modern news events. So you could really get a sense of what they were going through as they made their way deeper and deeper into the jungle. And then, of course, the dispatches suddenly ceased.
Did they have a big crew that went with them of bearers or whatever they called them in those days? There was
porters.
Fawcett himself, his son Jack, 21 years old, and Raleigh Rimmel. Did they have porters who came along?
You know, this was another thing that Fawcett was extremely went against the grain at the time. The early Amazon expeditions, like the early El Dorado expeditions, literally went in with armadas. I mean, the first El Dorado expedition had some 4,000 men, and quite literally, some of them were wearing armor, which was a bit foolish in the jungle. Mm-hmm. And Fawcett believed only in taking small parties. And he believed this because he thought it was the only way to persuade the tribes of his peaceful intentions. And so he was taking only three people. Now, they had two porters, kind of porters slash guides, who accompanied them kind of to the a little past the frontier into an early part of the wilderness. But then as they were entering the more dangerous territory, they became very scared, and Fawcett dispatched them back, and they returned with some of their letters and dispatches. And so then it was essentially just Fawcett, his oldest son, Jack, who really worshipped his father, and Raleigh Rimmel, who was Jack's best friend, and they had grown up in Devon, England together.
But this was tough, tough going, a really unrelenting jungle. You've got a bit of a description here from Fawcett's 1908 expedition. I wonder if you could read a bit of that for us, David.
Sure, I would be happy to. This is from the 1908 expedition, and what's interesting about this is they were looking for the source of the Rio Verde, and it was an unknown river in Brazil, and trying to find the source of this river evoked a little bit like the great search for the source of the Nile.
Had a nine-man party. Five of them died on this trip of disease and starvation.
That's right. Okay. Despite cutting, chopping, pulling, and pushing through jungle from morning till night, they usually advanced no more than half a mile per day. Their legs sank in mud, their shoes disintegrated, their eyes blurred from a tiny species of bee that is drawn to sweat and that invaded their pupils. Brazilians called the bees, quote, eye lickers. Still, Fawcett counted his paces and crawled up banks to better see the stars and to fix their position, as if reducing the wilderness to figures and diagrams might enable him to overcome it. His men didn't need such signposts. They knew where they were. The green hell.
The green hell, they called it. Was he crazy?
That's a good question. I mean, I think by our standards, anyone who spends nearly two decades in the jungle under those conditions has a different wiring than us. Fawcett was an incredibly complex and interesting character. He was very smart. He was very capable. He was an amateur back then. He didn't have, even though he trained at the Royal Geographic Society, these were not PhD. He wasn't a PhD archaeologist. He was a very driven. He could be maniacal on these expeditions. This made many of his companions who were weaker dislike him. But to some extent, he probably saved their lives by being so maniacal because he was able to get them out.
But you quote from one of his sons in a diary asking, was Daddy's whole conception of Z a spiritual objective and the manner of reaching it a religious allegory?
Yeah. What is very interesting is by 1925 when Fawcett set out, initially his descriptions of the city of Z were very scientific and the way he had pieced together his theory was very scientific. But then he had went to fight in World War I, and he was actually at the Battle of the Somme, which was just a horrific, and he was there and watched tens of thousands of people die, young lads basically just march out of those trenches into machine gun fire. And it was from that point on that Xi began to take on greater, almost allegorical and mythical proportions in his mind. And it really became a kind of other world. And by the end, there is certainly some evidence that a man who had really been deeply grounded in science had been driven somewhat mad by his obsession and by this vision of a lost world.
He wrote in a letter to a friend, "Those whom the gods intend to destroy, they first make mad." Why did he call it Xi, and what did he hope or expect to find?
It's interesting. There is no he never gave an explanation for why he called it the city of Xi. Fawcett was always a little bit cryptic, and he also, I think he also had a certain flair for drama, and the city of Xi certainly sounds better than the city of N. So
it had that
kind of allure and mystique. And as I was saying before, his descriptions of Xi change over time. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was very grounded. He thought he was going to find remnants of an ancient civilization, that there may still be some elements of the population that still are descendants from it, that he would find roads at right angles, that he would find temples, that he would find causeways, that he would find evidence of basically much larger populations. And as time went on, this became his descriptions. He studied the El Dorado texts, and he believed, like the El Dorado, that there was this kind of glorious ancient civilization. He sometimes said in some of his letters that the descriptions of gold were exaggerated. So he didn't necessarily believe that he would find tons of gold. But as time went on, as we were just talking about, his descriptions of Xi grow more florid and become much more utopian.
Almost like some magical city. David Grand's new book is The Lost City of Xi, A Deadly Tale of Obsession in the Amazon. He joins us from New York. David, let's hear from our listeners. In North Augusta, South Carolina, Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is, could these explorers have been, and the conquistadors, been sent on their way to this mysterious city so they did not desecrate the local tribes? Could it have been something that was used to deflect?
It's a great question. Like, we'll march that way. Go over there. There's gold over there. Get away from us, maybe.
Yes, I mean, there's a very sad account in the first El Dorado expedition, which was led by Pizarro, Gonzalo Pizarro, the brother of the Pizarro who conquered the Incas. Mm-hmm. And he's marching in, and he encounters in the jungle some members of a tribe, and he asks them where El Dorado was, and they didn't give him an answer he wanted, and he actually strung them up and essentially crucified them in an incredibly brutal fashion. He sicked some dogs on them. And, you know, there was always a question of was it mythical? Were they possibly the Indians protecting this ancient civilization and wouldn't want others to come in? You know, it's hard to say exactly in those accounts when what the tribes would tell them what their aims were. But one of the things that was very interesting about Fawcett is Fawcett was very respectful of the tribes he encountered, and he would listen to their legends. And they, in fact, told him many legends about ancient civilizations. And part of the way he pieced together his theory of this civilization was based on interviewing these tribes.
There's some quite incredible photographs in here of the Quikuro Indians doing a whirlwind spirit dance and other groups. The local populations ended up playing quite an important role here. What were the most important ones, and what was their interaction like?
You mean between Fawcett and the
mm-hmm,
tribes?
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things is when I eventually went in and tried to follow Fawcett's trail is I encountered many of the tribes which Fawcett had stayed with. And even though they don't have written records, they have oral histories. And they actually had oral histories about Fawcett and his expedition because they were among the first white men they had ever seen. And these oral histories are incredibly detailed. They're almost like epic poems. And they had great details about Fawcett and the conditions of his party and their encounter.
That they had been passed down generation to generation in oral tradition. Quite amazing. We'll hear more about that. Let's get a call from Cincinnati, Ohio, and William. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Fascinating discussion, so it is. When I was growing up in Ireland, we had very famous explorers also, and I was just wondering, maybe they might be able to answer for me, is that did Fawcett ever come into contact with, say, Sir Roger Casement or John Stanley, who went with Livingston? Did he ever go on expeditions?
Yes, let us pick it up, William. A great question. David Grant, how about it? Was there a sort of brotherhood acquaintance here?
Yeah. Well, Roger Casement, actually, there was an affiliation with Roger Casement. Roger Casement had actually come in initially and to do a report about some of the atrocities that were being committed by the rubber trappers against the Indians, and put together a report that described how this one company had slaughtered around 30,000 Native Americans.
We should remind listeners, this is the time when rubber harvesting was coming into great value as automobiles took off, and there were, as you say, tremendous depredation against local populations.
Yeah, that's right. This was the great and very bloody era of the rubber boom. And because, as you said, the cars, the development of cars and tires, rubber was in great demand, and rubber could be found in rubber plants in the jungle. But labor supply was very they were always short of labor, in part because the conditions of tapping rubber in the jungle was so difficult. And so what they would often do was try to enslave the Native Americans. And also what they would end up doing is when the Native Americans and the tribes would try to defend their territory and resist, they would often be massacred. And Casement had actually come in and done a report. And Fawcett was also very much on the forefront at the time of denouncing these atrocities and wrote many editorials. So they were tied and linked in that fashion. And in fact, Fawcett gave testimony to Casement, who was sent as basically a British envoy over, had given various testimony to government officials from England about what he had seen in the jungle and the treatment of the Indians. So they were tied that way. And in terms of the fraternity of explorers, it was very interesting because the actual explorers who were going into the Amazon were all kind of gigantic egos and kind of larger-than-life personalities, and they actually often clashed, and there was a great deal of competition between them and rivalry.
And then came you, David Grant. I wish you'd read just a little bit from your own description of here you are, you're deep in the jungle, you become separated from your party, and you're suddenly wondering, what on earth am I doing here?
Yes, okay. I looked up at the tangle of trees and creepers around me, and at the biting flies and mosquitoes that left streaks of blood on my skin. I had lost my guide. I was out of food and water. Putting the map back in my pocket, I pressed forward, trying to find my way out as branches snapped in my face. Then I saw something moving in the trees. "Who's there?" I called. There was no reply. A figure flitted among the branches, and then another. They were coming closer, and for the first time I asked myself, what the hell am I doing here?
What were you exactly doing there? What did you want to find? Did you want to come out with the bones of Fawcett? You want to find the city and plant your flag on it?
You know, as with any obsession, there is an irrational element that is almost defies easy explication. But my quest really began biographical in many ways, and it was much more writerly. I mean, for me, it was really by profession I tell stories and try to know all the details about the story.
Did you have to go in for 5 weeks into the jungle to do that? You could have sat at home with the diaries.
That was, right. Well, as I said, there was an element of rationality as I gathered more information and just little clues would gnaw at me. Knowing I had these coordinates and there were just elements of the story, I became more and more interested in the possibility, not just of what happened to Fawcett, but could Z really have existed? And there was some signs that people, modern scientists, no longer believe that the jungle was necessarily a counterfeit paradise. And there was basically kind of a breakaway faction of scholars who were now suggesting that it was possible that a place like Z might exist. And that notion really propelled me on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for the lost city of Z, about a Victorian-era explorer's quest in the Amazon, and a contemporary writer who retraced his steps in the jungle. David Gran is with us from New York. His new book is The Lost City of Z. We've got a lot of people who want to speak with you. Let's go first to Ed in Waterford, Connecticut. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you that I used to work on a merchant ship going to Brazil or Uruguay and Argentina.
Yeah.
And we used to go up the Amazon River. And one of the things that was interesting about it is that when you go up the Amazon River, you cross the equator two times in one day.
Wow.
But in those days, Henry Ford had a rubber plantation up in, I think it was in Manaus, up the river.
That's right.
He was going to grow, you know, get rubber because he wanted to produce stuff for his car himself.
And what year would you have been up there, Ed?
46.
1946. David, what do you know about Henry Ford's rubber plantation? And how deep into the lost city turf is that, or not?
It's testing my memory. I believe it was near Manaus, and was one of what happened during the rubber boom was various towns kind of sprouted up in the jungle that became, they had enormous amounts of wealth. And Manaus was one of these places that during the rubber boom had enormous amounts of money. In fact, they built the very famous story of them building this opera house with their wealth, which
right.
was millions of dollars. And they had all this equipment shipped up the up into the jungle that came from Europe. And Henry Ford, hoping to build his own plant, had set one up around there to produce rubber. Now, eventually, though, the rubber boom collapsed in the Amazon because of the conditions were so difficult to get the rubber. Other places eventually surpassed it out in Asia, and it was much there. They did it, they planted it. In fact, rubber seeds were smuggled out of the jungle and then replanted elsewhere. So eventually, I know that Ford's company and his plant there eventually dissipated along with the rubber boom.
Caller Ed, you were a sailor on the Amazon. You saw that jungle sliding by alongside the river. Did you ever have the impulse to climb over the rail and head into that jungle? Did it call out to you, or it looked like that green hell?
Did I ever what?
Did you ever want to climb off the boat and head into the jungle?
No.
Period. Not for a minute. Ed, thanks.
Well, I'll tell you, we were bringing coffee up to the United States, and we would load coffee. And I remember there was one particular night, all the lights were out except where they were loading the cargo. And it was the weirdest scene you'd ever see, you know. And it was these natives coming down that looked like natives with coffee on their heads. They had the coffee bags on their heads.
1946, in the middle of the night, you put us right there, Ed, and we're grateful for that. You know, David Grant, it's an interesting year because that was one of the years after the 1925 expedition disappearance, when this account surfaced that the three explorers, that is Fawcett and his son Jack and Raleigh Rimmel, were alive up in Xingu territory, and it was claimed that he was both a prisoner and a chief of the Indians, and his family, his wife, was still ready to believe it.
Yeah, for years after, many stories and rumors would come out of the jungle. There would be reports from missionaries or other explorers with various claims. And Nina Fawcett, who was Fawcett's wife, was extremely devoted to him and led a very difficult life because of all his expeditions. He was away most of the time, and he had basically bankrupted them by spending all their money on his expeditions. But she would sift through these accounts, and she longed to believe so much that her husband and older son was alive, that she often placed a lot of stock in some of these stories that were clearly preposterous.
Said she, even at that advancing age, was prepared to head into that jungle herself. Let's get a call from Peter in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and David. I was one of those jungle explorers inspired by Fawcett and by Leonard Clark. Back a long, long time ago, we parachuted into a remote part of the Peruvian Andes looking for a lost Inca city.
What year, Peter?
Well, 1963. Uh-huh. I was a student at Dartmouth and young and stupid. And
what did you find when you parachuted in?
Well, we found we were lucky to get out of there. The plan was, instead of going up through the river valleys the way lost explorers had done it. We were going to march triumphantly down Dry River valleys before the rainy season, but it came a little early, and we were almost killed by Indians and almost starved to death, and all of the horrors that David is describing so well. He's lucky to get out of there.
did you get a
glimpse? I'm glad you made it out of there.
Did you get a glimpse of anything that made you think you were onto something, or that Fawcett had been, Peter? Or do you look back on it now as a magnificent obsession, but maybe not more?
Well, there was a city discovered in, I guess, 2003, Yakutupa, and that was what we were looking for. That was much closer to Machu Picchu than we thought it might be. But we had read accounts of another explorer, Leonard Clark, who had described walls, which maybe were walls, maybe were just natural formations. But we spent 3 months cutting through the jungle. We had thought it was going to take an easy month, and we were just lucky to get out of there.
Peter, we're glad you did, and thanks very much for your call. David Grand, you write about more recent technology, satellite imaging, GPS, and magnetic imaging, and all the rest that has indeed begun, maybe, to justify some of what Fawcett, in his more scientific moments, imagined might be in that jungle. And with that kind of overturning a whole understanding of the history of human settlement in the Americas. What has emerged? Not from the end of a machete, but from a little bit more high-tech than that.
Yeah, it's really quite astonishing. For almost all of the 20th century, it was assumed that the Amazon had not, that none of these cities really would be there. At least the scientific community was incredibly skeptical. And they assumed that Fawcett had essentially sacrificed his life and even the life of his son on a mad fantasy. Mm-hmm. But in the last few years, a group of archaeologists have begun to go into various areas, and they're often aided by the kind of gadgets that Fawcett could never imagine, satellite imaging, ground-penetrating radars that can detect any sorts of buried artifacts. And they are starting to find that, in fact, there really were ancient settlements in this area, and that these settlements go way back. And that, in fact, there were had once been massive and large populations in the Amazon, and they're really showing that the notion of Z was much more than a fable, and it's overturning both so many of the prevailing assumptions about the nature of the Amazon, but also what and how Native Americans were able to overcome some of their geographical obstacles in the Amazon. And they're really exploding our perceptions of what the Americas looked like before the arrival of Columbus.
You've written just in the last few days, as people are paying attention to the book coming out, that it challenges the whole idea that humans came into the Americas, the Clovis people, across the Bering Strait up in what's now Alaska. This would predate that. With what implication about migration patterns and how humans showed up?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was always assumed that the Clovis were the first people who had settled in the United States, and they crossed the Bering Straits and then slowly migrated down south. But there's now been evidence found of human presence in the Amazon that is so old that it predates or certainly is around the same period that the Clovis were supposed to be in the Americas. So it's literally overturning the theory of, or challenging the theory of how the Americas were first populated.
Can you give us a description of what satellite imaging and all the rest is suggesting may have been the dimensions or appearance of this remnants of this civilization?
Yeah, well, it's really extraordinary, and we're really just at the cusp of this revolution in archaeology. And so essentially all the old paradigms have to be thrown out, but the new paradigms are still just being developed, and we're still really just getting a glimmer of what these ancient civilizations might have looked like. Fawcett had actually always believed there was more than one ancient civilization in the Amazon, and evidence is clearly showing that is likely the case. For example, in the Bolivian floodplains, where Fawcett had done a lot of his early expeditions, and he had once climbed these natural mounds of these great earth mounds. Mm-hmm. And when he was at the top of one of the earth mounds, he had found ancient pottery, or what he believed was ancient pottery. These are now being studied, and they're really showing that these huge mounds of earth were man-made. There are ways to overcome the leaching process from the rains so that you could grow agriculture, basically an ingenious way to overcome some of the obstacles so you could generate enough food supply. And connecting these great earth mounds are evidence of huge roads and causeways, the very same thing that Fawcett had claimed would be there. And that's just one area. And then in the Xingu area, which is, you know, thousands of miles away, where Fawcett had finally pinpointed the possibility of Z, they've uncovered 20 pre-Columbian settlements. And these cluster settlements were interconnected by roads. And some of these clusters, when you put them together, their population were the size of medieval European cities.
Wow, we're talking great scale. Virginia Beach, Virginia. Jillian, you're on the air with David Graham.
Hi, Tom. Hi, David.
Hi.
My question is, I'm wondering if in your research, David, if in England you came across the work of Colonel Thomas Mortimer Welsh. He met Nina Fawcett when he was wounded during World War II and became quite close to the Fawcett family. He was an explorer himself and was entrusted with Fawcett's papers, went into the jungles twice himself, I think the last time in the 1980s. And I wondered if you had come across his research.
David?
I believe it's the same person. There was somebody who had accompanied Brian Fawcett in the 50s.
This is the son of Percy, Brian.
Yes, this is the younger son. Mm-hmm. Fawcett had three children, and his younger son had eventually made a search of his own, hoping to find out what happened to his father, and he still clung to the hope and the possibility that Jack, who was very young, might even still be alive as late as 1953. And Welsh had Welsh actually accompanied a nephew. That's right. Welsh had accompanied Fawcett's nephew, who went much later, you're right, in the 80s. And they had gone and done some investigation in Mata Grosso. That's right.
Jillian, sounds like you know something about Percy Fawcett. How do you look back on this man and his obsession?
Well, I come at Percy Fawcett from Thomas Welsh was an explorer himself, and a tank commander during his service in England. And he was very much convinced through his contacts with Nina Fawcett and the family that his approach was the more spiritual approach. He had both the explorer instinct and the spiritual dimension that Fawcett came to. So that's how I came to know it. I met Thomas Welsh and came to know the Fawcett family through this.
There's that.
That's interesting. You know, the thing about Thomas and the nephew also who he went with, it was Timothy Patterson. And I had actually spoken to Tom several years ago. And their expedition had a much more spiritual aim. And one of the things that happened over time is that a lot of communities actually sprung up in the Brazilian area. Some even kind of worship Fawcett as a kind of god. But a lot of spiritualists were attracted to his story, and many began to believe that possibly it was basically a spiritualist journey. And Timothy M. Welsh were much more subscribers to that theory.
Jillian, thank you so much for your call. Let me get another from McGaughysville, Virginia. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was interested in asking about the first explorer down the Amazon who discovered the Terra Preta culture, the Kayapo Indians who used slash and char of the forest versus slash and burn. And according to Thomas Mann in 1491 and some others, that the fertility of this agricultural system could have supported up to 10 million people and or might be the origins of the whole myth of El Dorado.
David,
yeah, it's a great question. And this dark earth, which they are now discovering, is enriched by kind of organic waste. Essentially, when you have human settlements and you throw products of garbage, the ground can become enriched. The soil can become and get nutrients. And then the Kayapos also had a very sophisticated system of charring, which also added nutrients to the soil. And this was an ingenious way to take land, which might have been infertile, like a lot of the soils in the Amazon, and make it enriched and make it have enough nutrients that you could then farm within it and generate food. And it's really an incredible system. And some scientists believe that this that they've actually come up with a sophisticated way that this was actually that they didn't just use the natural byproducts from the soil. that was enriched, but that they actually ingeniously created the soil through the charring that the caller mentioned with the Cayo Pos. And this soil, this enriched soil, they're now finding throughout the Amazon, and they believe because of it that there were likely settlements, that the population in the Amazon had once been in the millions, and that that was possible. And not only that, that there were ways to generate food supply even in places where it would have otherwise been a counterfeit paradise.
It's an absolutely compelling story, and I guess not just to us. I see here that Paramount Pictures has picked this up, and Brad Pitt's production company is looking at developing a film out of this. Are we going to see you played on screen? As by Brad Pitt, or is he taking the Fawcett role here, David?
I think he's taking the Fawcett role. I think even for Brad Pitt, I would be it would be too big a leap. Yeah, he is slated to play Fawcett, and they've hired James Gray, who just directed and wrote Two Lovers, who's a fantastic director and screenwriter, and he's adapting it right now.
And are you over your obsession, David, or are you headed back in?
I think once was enough.
And Fawcett, they found a ring of his years later, and that's all. Did you end up with a conclusion, your own version of what happened with David Fawcett and his party, or Percy Fawcett?
Percy Fawcett. You know, as I was mentioning earlier, many of the tribes in the area have oral histories, and these oral histories have been passed down, and they hold incredible clues, I think, to what really happened. And I think I was able, ultimately, to get about as close as you ever could to knowing.
Well, it took a trip deep in the jungle to get it. We're glad you came out, and we're glad you brought the story to us. David Grand, thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Grand, author of The Lost City of Z, A Deadly Tale of Obsession in the Amazon. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.